Our life in Christ and of Christ expects, if not demands, that we love our neighbors as ourselves. Pope Francis has been especially clear in his brief pontificate to calling us again and again to the love for the poor, broadly construed. And in the course of its 2,000 years of history and tradition, the Church has developed a shorthand, if you will, for the concrete actions expected of the Christian faithful in expressing this love. We call them the works of mercy, those charitable actions by which we come to the aid of our neighbor in his spiritual and bodily necessities. I've always been particularly impressed that the first spiritual work of mercy is education. In another time and another place, I was an educator. I worked with public school teachers attempting to improve and sustain small rural public schools in Alabama. Our work focused on how to teach using local resources found in the community while still satisfying the ever-increasing demands for accountability from the state and the federal governments. Like teachers almost everywhere, we tended to look askance at the shrill demands for the application of standardized tests to measure academic achievement, preferring to believe that once we had arrived at a standardized student, we would then entertain the idea of a standardized test. Of course, it's not a realistic perspective in our political system. And so we routinely refer to the use of these tests within our work as a render unto Caesar moment. And part of our work was to consider how to accommodate the demands of the state with the needs of the student, knowing that total surrender to either side would mean a loss of something of the power to be found in education. We understood that there was a divide between what the state demanded for accountability and what teachers demanded for an authentic expression of their gifts in the classroom. And I think that's a worthy analogy for the gospel reading for today. Most teachers, all the good ones, regard their work as a holy, if not sacred, vocation. And the Church, throughout its history, regards education as one of the most basic works of mercy through which the work of Christ is seen. And especially in recent times, the demands of the state have come into conflict with those individual vocations. And especially in recent times, teachers have had to come to terms with how to balance the two. It's not common only to teachers. My current work in Catholic healthcare focuses in large part on bridging the divide between that which is required by the government and that which is expected by the Church. Regardless of our profession, many of us continue to walk that line between what we see as bureaucratic entanglements that are both necessary to our work in the world, while at the same time distract ourselves from it. And we understand this in many ways. The demands of board accountability, of red tape, of risk and insurance protocols, they all conspire to create an often fuzzy line between that which we must do and that which we believe we should do. Today's gospel reading presents to us an instruction from Jesus that is as clear as it is confusing, as obvious as it is deeply puzzling. Jesus instructs, "Then repay to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and to God what belongs to God." There's no sense of option here, nor is there any fundamental question about what Jesus wants us to do. Or perhaps there is. The question of how to cleave the distinction between that which is rightfully belonging to the state and that which belongs to God is one that has fascinated and tormented Christians since the time of this teaching. While Jesus is clear in his instruction, we remain puzzled about how to live authentically and realistically into its implications. And because this is not only about the immediate question of the distribution of money and taxes, but also more broadly about the line between earth and heaven, and most broadly about the sacred and the worldly, its implications ring through all of human existence as we make choices based upon and reflecting our faith in Jesus Christ. For some in our society who believe generally in the concept of God, this line is identifiable as the visible and the invisible, with the visible belonging to the world and the invisible belonging to God. For people like our fundamentalist neighbors up Wade Hampton at Bob Jones, the line is interwoven into the Greenville community between those who believe as they do and those who do not. For the Amish, a community I have particular respect for, though I don't want to join, the line is found in the considered use of technology. And for many other cults and sects throughout history, the line between the sacred and the profane, between that which belongs to the state and that which belongs to God, is found geographically as they separate themselves as a community apart from the world. But we don't actually have to go to those most obvious choices. We don't have to go to Bob Jones or the Amish to find those credible, clear distinctions, if you will, that cleaving between what is of God and what is of the emperor. Many amongst us think that religion and science are stand-ins for this divide. And in the midst of it all, we find some trying to be so holy and pure that they lose that sense of engagement with the world, the sense of fullness of life. Or those who've tried to be so worldly that they consign God to the realm only of the professionals. For those who value works of mercy in the world, none of these are satisfactory solutions to the questions found in Jesus' instruction. And the complexity to this nettlesome problem is not how to divide the worldly from the sacred, of God and from the emperor. It has to do more with a sense, with the question of identity. Jesus demands that they show him the coin, and he asks whose head and whose title. For the image of Caesar imprinted on the coin, for the image of Caesar imprinted on the coin is the signature of belonging. So too is it also for us. Each of us is created in the image of God and bears through baptism and confirmation the sign of Jesus Christ marked on our brows. And so it is we who belong to God, even while the money in our pockets belongs to the state. But this question of identity is not the end of the story. We bring our offerings of money into this church, and we take ourselves, formed in the image of God, out into the world. And yet, even this transcending of the boundaries between the sacred and the worldly, the things of God and of the state, pale in meaning compared to the radical statement of faith that each one of us makes as we take within ourselves the sacrament of Christ's body and blood, and then take ourselves out into the world. And it is there where this image of God resident on each one of us begins again to be obscured. We obscure that image through our own actions. We obscure it through the actions of others, through the actions of our community. We obscure it even through the never-ending concern that perhaps we are not worthy of bearing such an image. and it is obscured upon us, and it is restored time and again until such time as when both St. Paul and St. John promise that we too will be found bearing the image of Christ when he comes again. This is what being a holy people living in the world means. It is required of us each time we engage in the works of mercy. It means knowing, and if you don't know, then discerning what it is that belongs to Caesar and what belongs to God. It means, as 1 John says, to be in the world, but not of it. It means knowing, as teachers and physicians and clinicians and many other professionals do, the difference between that which they must do and that which they are called to do. It means always engaging in that ethical deliberation so that the fulfillment of the demands of Caesar never exceeds the love that is of God. Because while the fulfillment of the emperor's demands may bring us temporary respite, belonging to God bears eternal reward.